It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown T minus 5, 4, 3. Two, one.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 5.7.
Traveling around the world on opium dreams to find the magic elephant named Osama.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And we have with us today Lavi Tadar. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So let's start off with the easy beginning question, which is a hard hitter. Tell us a bit about yourself and kind of what drew you into writing.
What drew me into writing in general, or writing, fair
in,
enough.
In general.
In general, yeah.
In general. God, you do start with the hard questions, don't you? I suppose I just like books. That's what it comes down to.
That's too easy of an answer. We want more.
Yeah, no. I was the kid who kind of spends a lot of his time in the library. Going through all the available books and then rereading them and so on. And I think I've always wanted to be a writer, and I don't know why. It's definitely not a particularly glamorous thing to be doing. But I think the problem I had as a kid, you know, when you want to be a writer, is you don't actually have anything to write about. So I kind of went and spent the next 20 years or whatever trying to find, to have a bit of a life so I can write about stuff. So that was kind of my strategy.
How did you settle on science fiction and fantasy, I suppose?
Well, again, I think this starts early on, doesn't it? Science fiction and fantasy. I remember, you know, in the kind of diet I grew up on was a lot of, you know, you had the kids' books initially. We had a lot of the European stuff like Jules Verne and so on. We had Karl May, you know, who makes an appearance in the steampunk books I've been doing. But I think a lot of Europeans know who he is. I don't think, you know, English readers necessarily do. He pops up in that Quentin Tarantino movie, which I thought was really cool. But mixed in with those, you had the kind of the weird sci-fi stuff, and you had a few Israeli novels, weird young adult children science fiction fantasy. And I think that really interested me, because even then I realized there wasn't very much of it in Israel. You didn't get much original stuff. So I was always drawn to that kind of homegrown stuff. But I can't really explain what it is. I mean, in a way, I don't think I can write something that doesn't have a weird element to it. Whether I want to or not, it needs to have a sort of weird element, whether it's science fiction or fantasy or whatever it is. You know, I can't seem to write anything straight.
Do you think that the weirdness helped you particularly explore whatever it is you're trying to explore in whatever you're writing?
Well, I think it can be quite useful. I'm really attracted by pulp fiction. I'm really attracted by this formula writing that is where American science fiction comes from, is these pulps, you know, and the same for crime, noir and Private Eye and so on. They're very much about the formula, and I'm really fascinated by formulas, because once you have a formula, you can play with it. You can try and do new things with it. But it gives you this kind of artificial structure. And, what I do with Osama has that pulp Private Eye formula kind of imposed on it as a skeleton. And then, of course, plays with that quite a bit. Sorry, I lost my...
That's okay. That actually... That kind of brings us to the common question, because it brings us to your book. can you tell us a little bit more, and our listeners, a little bit more about your personal connection to Osama and what compelled you to write it specifically, and the impetus behind the book?
Well, it really started for me, I think. It started a lot earlier than for most people, because I grew up, or I spent quite a few years in South Africa, and part of the time, a lot of the time, I was actually backpacking around Africa, in, you know, since from 1995, 1996 to 1998. I was alternatively working in Johannesburg and backpacking across sub-Saharan Africa, and getting to quite a few interesting places. But in 1998, I was actually staying in Nairobi, and I was staying in a little hotel called the Hilltop Hotel, which is where the novel starts as well. And the Hilltop, as I realized later on, was where the Al-Qaeda operatives stayed. And obviously this was the year of the embassy bombings in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. And I was actually in Dar es Salaam when the bombings happened. So I was right there, and a week later I went back up to Nairobi and I got to see the American embassy after the explosion, you know, which was quite it was quite something to see. And obviously staying in the same hotel where the bombers stayed meant that I was aware, I think, early on of this thing called Osama bin Laden, of Al-Qaeda, when people weren't really paying that much attention to it, because it wasn't happening anywhere important, in a way. You see what I mean? It was happening in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, which is places people in the West don't necessarily have much of an awareness of. And over the years since then, you know, we've had a fairly close encounter in the Sinai, in the 2004 Sinai bombings, again by accident, and obviously the London bombings, 7/7. So it was almost as if someone was sending me a message. You know what I mean? You're kind of wondering, you know, when is the next time you're going to meet? And I was fascinated, by the whole effect of it. Obviously, the time when it did all come crashing out was September 11, which was one of the things I wanted to avoid in the book as much as possible, because it is such a big and such a difficult thing to write about. But the effect it's had, creating this whole war on terror, the invasion of Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. So it's a huge theme, and in a way, it's kind of like if you're a writer, how can you not write about it? You know.
Yeah, and actually, to piggyback on what you brought up is, it's interesting that for most Americans, until September 11th, for the most part, with rare exceptions, we'd never had the experience. We could never see the real, like, devastation of what an actual bombing looked like. But you actually got to see, like, the aftermath firsthand well before the events in 2001. So it seems, I wonder, like, for you, I mean, what kind of a difference do you think there is in seeing the devastation, like, with your own eyes, not in a picture, not in a video on a news network, but, like, actually seeing the rubble? Like, what is that? I mean, how did that sort of impact you?
Well, I mean, it's hard to answer, because partly, obviously, I grew up in an environment where this was a fairly common occurrence. I mean, I grew up in Israel most of my early years, where for a time this was a fairly regular occurrence. And then we moved to South Africa at the end of the apartheid period, during the transition to democracy, when again you had a lot of terrorist attacks going on there by the White Afrikaners, the AWB organization. So, you know, it's a fairly common thing in a way. It's something that surrounds you on a daily basis. But what really interested me was how this story that we were being told after 9/11 resembled essentially a pulp paperback. You know, it was very much these lines of good and evil, very Star Warsy. And I was kind of, what I wanted to write was a book that comes from, I suppose, my perspective, but a lot of other people's perspective, that says, well, I don't really understand. No one seems to understand this conflict. You know what I mean? The West seems to have a real problem understanding why this is happening to them, why Al-Qaeda, you know, and explaining, saying this is just evil is a very easy explanation for it, you know.
It's not really an explanation at all when you get down to it.
It's not, but it's an easy explanation. Whereas for the people of Al-Qaeda, for the people outside the West, you know, there is a sense, there's an immense sense of anger against this kind of imperialist power that is the United States and the effects that it has around the world. And so I wanted to kind of address both of these things from a perspective of someone who doesn't really understand what's going on. And I think a lot of the characters in the books don't really understand why this is happening to them.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. Yeah, there's a lot of the way the book kind of constructs its reality is very confused in that sense, that there things happen. I mean, particularly Joe, where he has no idea literally what's going on. He just keeps following these sort of breadcrumbs and hoping he's going to get to an answer. And yet some things kind of, I mean, maybe it's a poor metaphor, but blow up in his face. I think it was very interesting, like things like about like with the CPD, who seemed to sort of leave Joe alone until he starts to become aware of himself, as if somehow like finding out who he is and his place in all of this, it's kind of like a danger. And I guess like part of it's interesting that the irony is that the CPD in your novel also kind of they're meddling. Actually influences Joe to get him towards the answers. And I kind of, could you touch on sort of this element? I mean, do you see this as kind of like a hero's journey, or do you see it maybe as almost a tragedy for Joe?
I have a real problem discussing this because obviously I know what I read in the book, but I think there's several interpretations for the book, and I have my own interpretation for it. And, you know, I would argue it's not a genre novel, for one thing. Mm. If you read it in a certain way, it's not a genre novel at all. And obviously, if you read it in another way, it can be a pulp novel, it could be an alternative history. I think my personal feeling is that Joe is very much aware of what's going on. I don't think he wants to know. And I think that's the main conflict in the book. He doesn't want to know. He doesn't really want to find out. It's being forced on him. And, you know, and he has to make a choice towards the end. And that's related to that as well. The CPD, the Committee on the Present Danger, as we find out later in the book, is a real organization. Which, you know, I thought you can't make this up. We really are kind of looking at the story of the war on terror as a pulp story. And there really is a CPD. So I kind of imagine if they were in this situation, this is something they would do. I don't know how much we want to go into specific things in the book, or I don't know if people have read it or are interested.
Well, the only thing I would say is avoid spoiling anything past the halfway mark, because that's where a lot of really, really major events sort of take place. But if we can kind of like answer things and skirt around them, that would be fun too. Because there is so much going on in this book, and it is sort of difficult to talk about some of the themes and then also avoid spoilers. But because people really should read this book. Like, I really loved it.
Oh yeah, we are both firmly behind you as in terms of the quality of this. To me, one of the interesting things that I didn't put it in our notes, Sean, but was the whole idea of awareness and whether or not we are aware of things and the the idea of terrorism as a psychological versus a physical war. Basically that, you know, Americans, the West, has taken this up as a physical war, that this is somehow, obviously it is now a physical war. But terrorism itself is more of a psychological warfare. The fact that we turned it into a physical war seems to be part of the problem in the West. Do you think that is, I'm sorry, do you think you tackle that issue? I mean, I see it as, you know, the psychological awareness and the kind of, at points it becomes a physical war for Joe, but for the most part, this is a psychological journey into terrorism and the cultural aspect of it.
No, absolutely. I think his journey is very much psychological. It's true what you're saying, because terrorism is a media weapon. Terrorism is only effective if you see it. It's never about killing a large number of people. It's about creating the shock value and the fact you don't expect it and you don't know when it's going to hit. The fact is, a lot more people die from, you know, car accidents every day than ever die in terrorist attacks. But terrorism is a media weapon. It's not something that would have worked, I don't think, very effectively without mass media. So it's very much a part of that. It's all about the story we tell ourselves about the world. You know, I think one of the interesting things was, obviously we have Osama bin Laden, who's this very kind of black and white figure, opposed by George W. Bush, who was coming at it from a very black and white perspective as well. I think, you know, possibly a different leader at a different time might have constructed the story differently. One of the things that really interests me was the reporting of the Iraq war. And in the UK, I don't know what it was like elsewhere, but in the UK, they were consistently reporting it before the invasion of Iraq and later on. They were referring to Mr. Blair and Saddam, you know. And I was always wondering what would have happened if they were referring to Mr. Hussein and Tony. You know, it's a way the media constructs what we see. And that was a very definite bias, you know. That was a very definite way of looking at things that wasn't objective. And that's just an example of the way that was handled. So it's a lot about narrative. It's a lot about stories, you know, and how we construct them and how it's reported and how we're made to see them.
So speaking of narratives and how you choose to report them, the Osama bin Laden vigilante in the book, the books within the book, are very much essentially dry narratives of the events. You know, that you mentioned that it's more like a police reports or lab reports than it is what obviously the news media and turned into very much a more pulpy within our world. It turned into a more pulpy novel, but you turned your pulp novels into more of a report. What made you choose that that dynamic?
Well, I mean, to be honest, my initial inspiration for the Osama sections was Ed McBain, you know, the 87th Precinct novels, which are written in a very specific, detail-orientated way. But it's also the fact that you simply can't treat those events as a pulp story. Obviously, Joe's story is a pulp story. It's a constructed pulp story that possibly he constructs for himself. But treating the events that actually happen, or the ones that are fiction in the book but are real to us, I think you can't treat them in a sensational way. And one of the things that I try to do when constructing them, to simply be as detailed as possible about them. And I think the most frustrating day I spent was trying to find out which shoes Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, which shoes you actually wore, because apparently that's a bit of a trade secret in the fashion industry, that they didn't want that coming out, what brand of shoe he was wearing. So I mean, I even got a photo of them. I think they were just non-brand, to be honest, but black hiking shoes. But plus, you know, the more detailed you are, the more real it seems, the more honest it can be. The hardest part of the book for me was the ghost stories section, you know, which comes towards the end. And I actually thought that was going to be longer. Well, when I set out to, you know, when I had a fairly good idea of how the book goes, and I thought that section was going to be longer, and I realized it can't be. You know, I think it's about 3,000 words. And I thought it can't be any longer than that. And that was probably the hardest thing to write, because at the end of the day, you're writing about real people. You're talking about things that really happened. And that's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah, that was actually, that was for me, for sure, the most difficult part to read. You know, I was just reviewing the book this morning, you know, developing my questions, and I'm sitting here crying over the event. I could be starting my period soon, but I doubt that. I think it's because it's a very difficult subject to touch, period. But what I remembered when I first read the book was, I think the first time that you hit an Osama section, no matter how dry it was, that was difficult to read as well. And I remember getting teary-eyed and upset over that portion. Because maybe it's because of my own worldview, and you know, I try to tell my kids you have to take both sides of a story, and I think you did that really well with the Osama sections of not judging the bombers necessarily, and just reporting it as an event. But yeah, it was difficult to read, and particularly now that we just hit the 10th anniversary of the attacks, but we're, I think, and at the moment of the 10th anniversary, Americans were really questioning, and probably still are questioning, the too soonness of sorts of, you know, literature, film, television, whatever, talking about the events. So do you think it is too soon to an extent, or do you think that now is the best time to start discussing these things?
Well, for me, that wasn't really a consideration. I don't really believe in that there's something you can't talk about, or right, you know, or you can't start talking about it. For me, it was more when I started writing in Laos, which was a while ago now, and it was more a matter, it's a story that's been sitting in my head for a long time. It was more a matter of, can I do it, you know, because it's quite scary to try and sit down and write something that you believe in and worrying that it's not going to come out, that it's not going to be good. So that was the main delay for me, that I wanted to wait until I was ready to write it. And as soon as I started writing it, it was the easiest thing I've ever done, I think, because it just felt right for me to do it. And I think what happened was, obviously it's a very difficult book. It's a very difficult book to sell, and it's a very sensitive book. And, you know, I loved it. My agent loved it. And we were, I think, slightly misguided, because we thought, well, you know, we both think it's a really good book and it's an important book, and it's not going to be any problem selling it, you know, which was not the case, as it turned out. And we had all kinds of weird rejections. You know, we had one rejection that basically said, I love the book, but I don't want to get bomb threats in the mail like I did at my previous employer.
Wow.
And so I'm going to pass on it. We've had, you know, a lot of comments about changing the names. But part of the problem as well wasn't just the political aspect of it, but because it doesn't treat it in the way people necessarily expected to treat it.
Right.
Because it takes that kind of very, very twisting route through it. And we were very lucky that in the end of the day, Pierce Publishing was a small publisher in the UK who picked up the book. Now, what happened then, of course, is that they and we were kind of making jokes about, you know, finding Osama bin Laden, and of course they found him, and supposedly they found him, I should say, and executed him, and then that made it even worse in a way, because then they're saying, oh, well, it's not relevant anymore. You know, because he's gone. Whereas he doesn't, you know, the book, it doesn't matter for the book. As you've read it, Osama bin Laden is not actually in the book at any stage. It's, his shadow is in the book. But it's been a very strange experience. But there's nothing you can do, really. You just have to kind of write the best book you can and hope that it finds a home. I don't think it's missed the boat, in a way, and I don't think it's too soon either. What did happen was, what did happen though is once they've, I've been obsessed with this thing. I've actually started, the whole Osama thing started with a short story that I did for an Ellen Datlow anthology in 2006, I think, called My Travels with Al-Qaeda, about these two, this couple that's caught in a time loop between the various terrorist attacks that I've been near to. And I kind of knew that those two characters in the story were going to be in the book. You know, Joe and the mystery girl in the book are basically these two people from my travels with Al-Qaeda. And then I went and wrote another story called Wrong Number, which went to a literary magazine a couple of years ago, I think. That also deals with Osama. And once they've caught him, once that whole thing happened, I realized I really can't ignore... You know, I can't ignore that fact, and I ended up, and I have to do one more Osama story just to get it out of my system, just to kind of put an end to it. So there's actually a story called The Last Osama coming out in Interzone next month, I think, which hopefully is the last of it. And it's I like to think of it as a story by Mike Longshot and me. So we collaborated on this. On this story, which deals with the Osama assassination or execution or capture.
But that actually brought up, you kind of covered one of the questions I had, which was the fact that your book came out right around the same time that Osama bin Laden was, as you say, supposedly killed. We assume that he was, but I guess since they buried him at sea... or something. I mean, but since he hasn't come out, I mean, I'm assuming he's not actually alive. So, but it does seem like that placement of your book on the shelves, metaphorically speaking, like a conspiracy theorist might like go crazy with that, you know, that this is some sort of grand plot to, I don't know, like put fluoride in our water or some craziness. but it just seems, I guess you kind of talked about the reaction, but it seems so like that the suspicious release. How did you sort of react to that? Like, well, he's gone, and now I've got a book coming out that's about this. Like, what was your initial reaction to that moment of knowing I have a book called Osama coming out?
I can't say. I mean, at that point, you know, I think I already had the book deal. I already knew it was coming out. And I don't think I cared or I didn't care anymore. It was a very frustrating process. The whole getting to publication, finding a publisher, getting through it. But to me, it never really mattered because Osama bin Laden as a person isn't really very relevant. You know, whether you kill him or not,
right,
doesn't really make much of a difference. It's Osama as an icon, as a myth. You know, it's a mythical figure that still has importance today, that's going to be relevant for a long time to come. And it was interesting because my if you look at the art for the book, which is by Pedro Marquez, who's done all my Pierce Publishing book covers, and he's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
And sorry.
Oh no, go ahead.
Oh, and Pedro had a post online recently talking about how he designed the cover. Yeah, now I thought, and my agent thought as well, you know, we both had this idea that the Osama cover will have to be a pulp paperback cover, you know, kind of echoing these 1950s Private Eye covers. And Pedro went completely the other direction. He basically designed this very iconic cover based on a 1950s, on the 1950s sort of Penguin paperbacks, if you remember, what these very iconic 60s artwork. And he's basically saying, you know, it's this image, it's this silhouette, it's so iconic, which is what he needed for the cover. It's, you know, so the death of the man himself, I don't think it matters. Al-Qaeda was never about one person. It's never been an organization in the traditional sense. But as an icon, you know, we're never going to be able to ignore him.
So what do you think, what in your opinion is the particular relevance of this book at this point in time?
Well,
big one. Okay.
That's a tough one. I mean, I can't make any claims about the book. I can only hope that people pick it up and they make up their own minds about it. I'm not even sure. I mean, even the very positive reviews that have come out, I'm not sure how much of what I necessarily intended comes across. There's some clues, there's some visual clues and other clues buried very deep within the book that, you know, I wouldn't have picked up on as a reader. And as you mentioned earlier, well, I don't know if you're gonna talk about it later or not. So I'll leave it. But
no, don't leave it. Go.
So Nangilima, for instance, which is, right, I think, is mentioned this once. You know, it's a reference to the Brothers Lionheart, which is a classic children's novel, European children's novel, that talks about these two brothers who die and they go on to this other world, and there's a world beyond that one.
Right.
So there's a lot of elements. There's a lot of elements from film in it that you can recognize. Some of them more obscure than others. So it's a question throughout the book is where, you know, why is this stuff the way it is? Where why is this world like this? And I mean, is it relevant? I hope it's relevant. I hope it's saying something about the way we see the world and about this conflict that we're in. But I essentially I see it, you know, as a love story. I think that's what it is.
Sorry, I'm thinking about that. That's I mean, to me, it actually took kind of the rereading backwards to pick up on some things. I, you know, the subliminal messaging of your book, because the first time I read it, I don't think I had really picked up on the mystery woman, and she was there. I mean, she's very much one of the shades that you know, obviously other characters are as well. But I don't think I had picked up on her identity as multiple characters, and her desperation in terms of getting Joe back. Until I went back and read some of the portions again. And then, you know, and sort of his adventure, her pushing him towards awareness, was an element that I think I was in a sense kind of avoiding the first time I read the book. I was reading it. I mean, 'cause I think there's a lot of stuff going on, obviously. In a way, it's a very educational book as a Westerner, where our narrative is very much shaped by news media. And unless we're actively trying to seek out other narratives, the fact that you mention opium and that opium wars are not funded, or wars are not being funded by opium, that was a really interesting element. And when I told my husband, he was like, "You're lying, you know, that's not true." And I'm going, "No, it really is. I went and looked it up." But that's not something that anybody ever really talks about in the West, at least not on the broader stage. So you put so much into it, I think, that it's relevant on a number of levels, is basically what I'm getting to. Do you agree with that statement?
I hope it does. The opium thing, you know, as I said, I wrote this book in Laos, which was pretty much the ideal place to write a book like this. And obviously it's the place where the book starts and ends, you know, and it's where Joe kind of hides himself in, because it's a place so remote from this conflict. You know,
right.
it's a Buddhist country. It's far away from that conflict, and yet it's a place that's been in the heart of the American war in Vietnam. You know, there's been something like 2 million bombs dropped on Laos during the war, the secret war, as they called it. So even today, a major problem in Laos is children going out into the fields or wherever and digging up bombs and losing arms or legs, or, you know, there's organizations. Now, one of the interesting people I met in Laos was an American who was working on artificial limbs, you know, helping people who have lost arms and legs from these bombs, from these American bombs. And his previous posting was in Afghanistan, doing the same thing in Afghanistan. Now, obviously, Laos is also one of the major opium centers, or used to be one of the big opium centers. And opium is really interesting, because we don't think about opium very much, do we? But think about painkillers, you know, think about pain. And the only real solution we have to pain still is opium derivatives, is morphine in particular. And I don't
real
know.
Quick, my husband actually has spent the last 5 days on opium derivatives, so he just has his appendix removed. So while I was preparing for this, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, he was on morphine for 2-3 days, and now he's taking heavy doses of Vicodin, which obviously is a codeine, another derivative. So, and until I hadn't really thought about that level, is that it is so common in the United States that we don't even think about it. We don't even think of where it comes from. We just take it for granted that it's there, it's available. And obviously, opiates must be legal because we're taking them all the time. And so therefore, someone must be producing them legally. And I think the assumption is in the United States that, at least, that these derivatives must be synthesized and have absolutely, you know, that they don't necessarily have a source out there somewhere in the greater world, that they don't have a source in places like Afghanistan or Laos or India or the many, many places that are producing opium. But when you think about the fact that it is, it becomes such a larger issue, because we primarily associate wars in the Middle East with oil. We never tie them to other products, which I think is a problem, obviously, in Western dialogue. So,
are you saying now that the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are for opium? That we are? It might be. that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but the fact that we do rely so heavily on it.
And it's very addictive, which is very disconcerting, that, you know, people say we're addicted to oil, but people are legitimately addicted to to like Vicodin. So
they're a nice metaphor for each other. But I mean, and we've talked, I mean, the United States foreign policy, the issue has come up of whether or not to start allowing the people of Afghanistan to legitimately grow opium, because currently most of what they produce is for illegal purposes. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Levy, but I believe we get most of our opium, legitimate opium, from, I think, India or something. But that adds an even more complicated level, because that, you know, there's so many issues going on in the Middle East and India versus Pakistan, where you also have a lot of opium produced. So yeah, you can't ignore it as a political impetus for a lot of issues, I think. And I don't most Americans don't even think about that or are aware that that's an issue at all. So the fact that it's in this book was, to me, that dropped me on my butt more than I think any other point in this book. So I'm sorry.
Right. No, I mean, I think the opium is more of a metaphor. Obviously, it's used as a kind of gateway for the characters. It enables them to see certain things, and it draws in a way again on pulp traditions of, you know, the dope fiend and the yellow menace. You know, these literatures that were quite racist, but that fascinate me. But yeah, the opium thing, I mean, I was doing the research, and I was exposed to a lot of this because of, you know, being around people who were working with this in various ways, you know, whether they were concerned with smuggling and policing, or whether they were concerned with it in a medical capacity. Now, yeah, India and Tasmania, I think, are the two largest producers of opium in the world. You know, and I think one of the arguments that's been made against Afghanistan was, or the excuses is that we can't, it's not good quality enough to be medical opium. Basically, but you know, you do kind of wonder what would have happened if Afghanis were allowed to grow the stuff that have been growing for centuries, for generations, for a Western market that actually does need it.
Right.
And one of the big problems we have, one of the things I think it's addressed in the book, but one of the problems we have is that first world countries get the medication, but you know, developing countries don't have cheap, easy access to medication that they need. And Africa, for instance, you know, you need this medication, and you can't buy it. So it's an ironic thing, because you're controlling this market. A, by controlling the legal aspect of it, and then spending a fortune fighting the illegal aspect of it. Whereas you could do a lot of good by making this kind of medication available to the people who need it at the cost they can afford.
Yeah.
So it's an element of the book. I wouldn't say it's a major element.
No. It was just a fascinating element.
I was fascinated by it as well when I was reading up on it, and obviously talking to people who actually work, you know, for the UN or for other agencies, and you know, and having to deal with this stuff on a policy level.
Yeah, and I don't want to get too deep into it, but people should, if they're interested in the issue of like why medicines are not accessible at prices developing countries can afford, you should really look into the way the patent system is constructed, because that has a lot to do with it. The fact that you can't make cheap knockoffs until the patent goes out and they're allowed to buy the license to make the knockoffs. And that's part of what, for us in the US, and I'm sure in the UK and elsewhere, that's why we get really good cheap drugs, because eventually we get the patent goes out and you can make like cheap knockoff, you know, Vicodin or whatever, right? But in developing countries, they can't even get they have to wait and can never even use the drugs that we're now using because they can't get past the patent system. So, and they get in trouble for it. If they go past the patent system and like, oh, we're going to sue you. And then, you know, you get sued by the United States, your country basically goes down the pooper. So, sorry. Now, anyway, I don't want to go too deep into that. That was my own like political nonsense. So switching back to the book real quick, and we've kind of brought up a lot of the references already, but I did really find it interesting the way that you sort of put a lot of references to sort of pop culture and major events, like even when they hadn't happened yet. Like Jen had mentioned that she thought it was really funny when there's a scene where Joe is being kind of interrogated and they're asking him questions about all of this stuff, and they get confused that they think Asian fusion might be a bomb. And they don't realize, you know, well, Asian fusion, it's not. But because they're trying to figure out what are all of these things, you know, what is a Scud missile? Like, what does it look like? And, you know, Asian fusion. And I really liked, I mean, kind of like there are scenes when you start talking about, you don't talk about them in specific details. You just kind of, or you give details, but you're not giving me like dates, but you'll give me like descriptions of people who might be terrorists, and I'm going, is that Ted Kaczynski? You know, the Unabomber? I'm like trying to make the connections between characters that are being mentioned. So I'm interested in what do you think is sort of really important about these kinds of references in creating what might be an alternate reality for Joe? It seems like they're helping us look at how our world we live in is constructed as an event-based reality that, you know, like people watch the news, like we're always, oh, well, the Middle East, it's, you know, a bunch of bombs are going off over there. So that's how we're thinking about the Middle East, and opium is going on over here, and the UK has Tories, and, you know, like we're thinking in terms of events. I don't know if that's really a question, but have at it.
Well, see, this is where I don't want to get into it too deep, because I have my own interpretation of the book and what's happening in the book. I'm just not sure I should be imposing it on any reader. I think there's a very definite, very obvious to me reason why all these references, all these very specific references are there, which, again, have to do with Joe, eventually. And the fact that a lot, you know, without giving too much away, a lot of this world he inhabits seems to be patched together from bits of obscure old films and bits of books and a lot of pulp fiction and so on. I do like that when they're interrogating him, because that is one of my favorite scenes. That Asian fusion line, I do like that quite a bit.
And flash mobs.
The flash mobs. I'm glad you saw that. I love that there's that flash mob thing and in there, you know, as a passing thing that he sees, that obviously makes absolutely no sense unless you know what it is.
Right.
You just wouldn't understand what these strange people are doing, just standing there, you know, dancing without any sound. But it did occur to me that if this Committee on the Present Danger was in this world, then, and they were aware that these things are going on, possibly coming from another reality or whatever, then they would try and use it for military gains, and they would try and make sense from all this material, but because they don't know what's important and what's not, what's real and what's not. So Area 51 and Asian fusion get mixed up with Scud missiles and nuclear weapons and the internet. But yeah, that was a fun bit to do.
All right, my last question on the book before we start wrapping everything up. The fact that you included a convention. Why? But it was great. I loved it, but why?
Okay, I'll tell you a little secret. My agent, it drives my agent mad. I think for some reason, and I've never been to very many conventions, or, you know, I've pretty much the last 5 years I've been living on a desert island and then in the most remote country in Southeast Asia and then in Israel. But for some reason, every book almost that I've written has a convention scene in it, even though they get cut out normally. So the Bookman, the steampunk novel from Angry Robot Books, actually had a massive convention scene in the middle of the book. It had a murder mystery in a Victorian science fiction convention. And that got cut out and replaced with a single sentence, you know. I still want to do something with it because that was fun today. But I think I'm just fascinated by, again, it's that sort of constructed reality. You know, it's this very, it's this pocket universe, this artificial reality that gets created for a few days that exists outside of normal reality. And I think that's really interesting. And it's also that obsessiveness of you know, science fiction fans, fantasy fans, book collectors, you know, it's an obsession that I understand all too well, unfortunately, and it's just very interesting for me as a construct. And it seemed, again, it seemed kind of sensible that if you're writing about an obscure pulp writer, that he might have just a tiny little bit of fandom who get together and are the chosen people because they're the only ones who get it, sort of thing.
Should note that this particular scene we're talking about does involve Osama bin Laden fan fiction, which I find
and
amusing.
Costumes.
Well, and costumes, yes. and an academic fanzine. So it's very, I like it.
it was. But, you know, the other thing was, I think, that comes across is that if you have all these refugees hanging around, you know, where would they go to kind of find meaning? They might go to this place, you know, which is where Joe ends up, because this is one place you might just get some answers. But it was also, it's kind of ironic, isn't it? Because no matter how awful it is, you'd get that group of people who are just into it. It's, I don't know, I don't quite know why I do it. As I said, they keep popping up, these conventions, in various books, and they normally get cut out before they're published. But they seem to serve a function in this particular case.
For sure.
Excellent. Well, we're basically out of time. We ran quite long, so we had a very good discussion. So the last quick thing before we close out, where can people find you, find your books, that sort of stuff?
Well, Osama is available for the Kindle on Amazon, and unless you want to get a UK hardcover, which is a bit pricey, but we did make it available on the Kindle to allow people to get hold of a copy. I've got a series of a trilogy of steampunk novels from Anger Robot Books, which should be in all good bookshops. And I've got a website, levitidar.co.uk, and I hang out on Twitter far too much for anyone's liking. So just find me on Twitter if you want to have a chat.
Excellent. Well, we'll make sure there's links to all of that in the show notes. So thanks very much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you. You gave me some things to think about more deeply in your book.
Well, thank you. Thank you both very much.
Of course. For having me.
Alrighty. Well, all right. So we got to close out. So if anybody wants to send us hate mail that we can forward anonymously to Levi, we're not actually going to do that. It's a joke. That would be mean. You can do that a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
Send us a tweet.
Twitter.com/SkiffyandFanty.
Go to our Google Plus page.
Shawnee Jen.
Or on our blog.
SkiffyandFanty.wordpress.com.
Yeah, and if you've read any of Levi's books, let us know. We'd like to hear from you. So thanks again, Levi. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And goodbye.
Bye.
And scene. Okay, there we go.
And we're done.
That was a really
thank
awkward
you, Levi.
Goodbye.
Brilliant.
Caution. You have entered the podstruction zone. Please secure all podcatchers. Caution.
How's it coming, guys?
You have entered
this won't go any faster if you keep interrupting.
Got it. Here's some steampunk, diesel punk, gothic punk.
Goth punk?
Gothic. Trust me on this.
Hey, you're the one who invited him to the show, Sean. I've got epic fantasy, sword and sorcery, and all the news on ebooks.
That's it! Check it out! Clock pump! Ooh, shiny.
I have space opera, time travel, Stargate, and...
Sean, is that He-Man?
Shut up. Boys, I think we did it.
A superior podcast.
Publishing, writing, genre, best-selling authors, and the hot new writers of today.
Editors and agents contest? Did we leave anything out?
AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com.
Subscribe today. Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature since 2006.
Sean?
It's just so beautiful.
Podstruction complete. Enjoy.
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France,
It's a different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.